Right, amazing. So firstly, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well.
Thank you. What would you prefer to be called?
Everybody calls me Bob. And that's my name is Robert.
Yeah.
But the only person who ever called me Robert was my mother when she was very angry with me. As in, Robert, get in here. otherwise, everybody calls me Bob.
Okay. So can I call you Bob? Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Amazing, Bob. What drew you to medicine?
Well, I actually decided at some level that I wanted to be a physician when I was in grade school. I would say that I was probably about 8 years of age when I decided to become a physician, and I never wavered from that. The impetus to my making that decision is very clear. It was my family physician in the Bronx, a man named Dr. Joseph Feibusch, who was an internist and general practitioner and was my family's physician. And he would make house calls. And I was just so taken with the idea of this profession. He was a guy who knew stuff that ordinary people didn't know. He knew all this science, which he was happy to explain to me. And then he was able to apply this scientific knowledge that he had to making people feel better. And I remember thinking to myself, I can't imagine a better thing to do when I grow up than be like Dr. Feibusch. So I decided that was exactly what I was going to do. When I was older, I realized that what I had experienced at such a young age is what we use the term a calling. Okay, I had experienced a calling to the practice of medicine. Now, I think many people associate the term calling exclusively with clergy, a calling to be a priest or a minister or a rabbi. But I think you can have a calling to almost any type of endeavor. And I was fortunate enough to have such a calling as a youngster. And so that greatly clarified my growing up period. I didn't have to spend a lot of time figuring out what it was I was going to do.
Yes. Okay, so would you say that science, and specifically biology, is a natural talent? Or would you say that with the right guidance, anyone can do it?
I would say in terms of learning the material, anybody with a reasonable level of intelligence can learn science. Now, maybe not everybody could learn astrophysics. I suspect I couldn't. And the mathematics would probably be beyond me. But in terms of biology, I think that any person with the right instruction and a modicum of intelligence discipline can certainly learn the basic concepts of biology.
That's amazing. Thank you. So many of us at the Young Scientist Journal, we aspire to become a scientist someday. Do you have any advice for those of us who want to pursue chemistry or biochemistry like you did?
Well, I think the younger you begin to emphasize sciences in your curricula at, say, high school level, the better, because there's so much to learn. I would say when I look back on my own training, I wish that I had taken more mathematics, because mathematics and statistics are so important in any branch of science for handling data. And I wish I had taken more mathematics when I was in college in particular. The other thing I would recommend is that if you actually want to be what we'll call a practicing scientist, somebody who does research, I think anybody can learn to do that, again, with the same provisos I made before, with a modicum of intelligence and perseverance, etc. Not everybody can learn to be a great scientist. I think that requires two additional ingredients. One, perhaps a higher level of intelligence, which one may or may not have. And two, appropriate mentors. There's probably nothing more important to the training of outstanding scientists than that they have been exposed to and mentored by outstanding scientists.
Yeah.
What I speak of here are lineages in science. Yeah. We can get into that more if you want in a bit. But if you look at almost any outstanding scientist, Nobel laureates, whatever,
mm-hmm.
you will find that they invariably have trained with other scientists who are outstanding.
So
my advice to aspiring young scientists is to become involved in lab projects as you proceed through high school and college and then, of course, graduate or medical school, and try to work in the laboratories of outstanding scientists if you can.
So would you say that you would you owe your success to a specific mentor?
Not to any one mentor. I was fortunate. Most of us who train in science have several mentors along the way. I had three. And from each one, I drew different things. Okay. And then I made my own synthesis, if you will, of what I thought were the most important things. But, you know, the things that you get from a mentor are not specific pieces of knowledge or a specific way to do an experiment. It's more an approach, an attitude, a sense of taste for what constitutes an important scientific problem. What should you work on? What problems are both tractable but important? When do you stop working on something which is not trying to, when do you stop working on something which is not working? And when do you push on? You know, the old business of you got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them. It's all of these kind of more subtle aspects of the scientific process that you can gain from a really talented mentor.
All right, amazing. Could you give us a broad overview of your work?
Yes, my work has to do with hormone and drug receptors.
Yes.
So when I began my research, which was a little more than 50 years ago, it was not known that there was such a thing as receptors. We knew that drugs and hormones worked on cells, that mm-hmm. They had specific effects on cells to stimulate enzymes and to lead to changes in cellular metabolism and activities. Very little is known about how that worked. But it was known that there was a great deal of specificity to their actions. So certain hormones worked on some cells and organs, but not on others.
Yeah.
And then even within a particular organ, only certain cells might respond. Moreover, you could have one drug which stimulated a cell, and then another which specifically blocked the actions of that agent. For example, you might have epinephrine, which can stimulate a heart cell. And then you might have what's called a beta blocker, which is a commonly used drug, which could essentially block the effects of epinephrine, but it wouldn't block the effects of, say, insulin or glucagon or histamine. So it's very specific. So all this suggested that there might be some sort of molecules on cells with which hormones and drugs and neurotransmitters specifically interact, okay? Yeah. Almost like a lock and a key.
Yeah.
But it was not really known whether this was true or if it is true, what in the world these molecules might be. And they were referred to as receptors, mm-hmm. okay? There might be receptors for hormones and drugs. So in the late 60s and early 70s, I set out with the very strong conviction that all sorts of data supported the idea that there must be such a thing as receptors. And so I set out to try to develop means initially to prove their existence, okay? And I chose as my model system, so-called adrenergic receptors. Adrenergic is an adjective derived from the term adrenaline.
Mm-hmm.
And my idea was to radioactively label certain molecules, which are called beta blockers. These are chemicals which can specifically and competitively block the actions of adrenaline, to label them with radioactive isotopes and use those to try to label these receptors in cells and tissues. And this took me years, but eventually we succeeded and were able to prove that there was such a thing as a specific receptor. And from there, we went on to actually purify these receptors from cell membranes. That was an extraordinarily difficult job. It took about 10 years because the receptors are so rare. There are very few of them in the cells. And in fact, since they were present in the membrane of the cell, before we could even begin to purify them, we had to solubilize them to get them out of the membrane with detergents. But eventually we were able to do it. That was probably another 10 years. And on it went. But anyway, we purified them, we cloned their genes, and did all kinds of other things, and discovered in the process that the adrenergic receptor, the beta adrenergic receptor, was one of a huge family that we now know to include about 1,000 different kinds of receptors.
Wow.
Which includes receptors for like everything, serotonin, dopamine, histamine, adrenaline, glucagon, parathyroid hormone, it goes on and on and on. But not just that, many of our senses are mediated by the receptors. We taste things via these receptors. We smell things via these receptors. One of the receptors in this family called rhodopsin is how we see. And we showed that all of these receptors are members of the same gene family. They all have a highly conserved structure in which the protein chain, which as you know is made up of amino acids,
yeah.
weaves across the plasma membrane 7 times, okay?
Yeah.
Now all these receptors work by activating another kind of transducer protein called the G protein. The G stands for guanine nucleotide regulatory protein, because downstream of the receptors is a special signaling molecule called the G protein, because it binds and hydrolyzes a nucleotide called guanosine triphosphate, or GTP.
Mm-hmm.
So the receptors are often referred to as GPCRs, that is G protein coupled receptors.
Okay.
And so my work has basically involved the elucidation of these receptors, how they work, and then the discovery of other proteins which regulate their function, of which there are two types. There's a small family of protein kinases, kinase being, you remember, a molecule, an enzyme, which transfers the terminal phosphate from ATP to a protein. Okay, yes. That's a kinase. And there are a small family of proteins called G protein coupled receptor kinases, which phosphorylate those receptors. And that leads to the binding of a second type of protein called an arrestin, so-called because it arrests signaling by essentially blocking the ability of the G proteins to interact with the receptors, thus leading to a phenomenon we call desensitization. Turns out this system has many functions in addition to turning off signaling, and it itself, the breastins, the arrestins, and the kinases can also serve as a signaling system in their own right. And they also mediate the internalization or endocytosis of the receptors once they're stimulated. So there you have, in about 5 minutes, my entire 50 plus year career. I would point out that although my research was always carried out at a very basic or fundamental level, it has had very significant clinical and therapeutic ramifications, because based on this work, much other work has been done. And today, about a third of all FDA approved drugs in this country are drugs which target the receptors in this GPCR family. So that's about 700 drugs. So even though this was basic research, the clinical ramifications of it have been significant.
I mean, your work is really, really, really impressive, Professor. And, you know, I'm usually a math person, so I really love listening to you talking about your work. And it really got me interested in biology. Let me just go ahead and say that.
The combination of mathematics and biology is a very, very strong combination.
I hope to pursue that in the future. Okay, so is there any topic in biology or biochemistry that you don't enjoy?
Well, I think I enjoy all topics, but the problem is there are certain areas of modern biology where I don't understand as much as I would like. For example, some of the details of molecular genetics and DNA biochemistry. It's not that they are less interesting to me. It's simply that I haven't done the reading of the basic material, which would allow me to better understand and appreciate the most current work in those fields.
Yeah, okay. So how do you see biochemistry advancing in the future?
Well, you know, biochemistry is an interesting field. It really is work that falls at the intersection of two fields, chemistry and biology. So that essentially biochemistry is the chemistry of living things. And just for me personally, that makes it the most fascinating kind of chemistry. Because to me, and again, this is my own personal viewpoint, what could be more interesting and exciting than understanding the chemistry of living organisms, which, I mean, is just so complex, it's almost unimaginable. How science advances is, you know, by two types of processes. You have the big discoveries, many of which are based on serendipitous or accidental findings. And then you have the steady plotting, putting one foot in front of the other advances. And that's sort of always how it has been and how I think it always will be. And making the big, important, fundamental discoveries is sometimes due to somebody just being, you know, remarkably creative. Sometimes it's due to them being just very lucky and stumbling into something. More often than not, it's due to the concurrence of both of those things. So I think in general, that's how science will continue to advance.
Amazing. In what ways did winning a Nobel Prize in chemistry change your life?
Well, winning the Nobel Prize was just the most remarkable experience. And I think every laureate has their own experience of it. Mine was interesting in several respects. First of all, people had been talking about my winning the prize for probably 20 years before I did. I was 69 years of age when I won. That's on the older side, but nowhere near the top. I mean, they say that the average age of a laureate is late 50s. But in my group, we had a guy who was 88. And we had several people who were my age. So not all that unusual. But people had been talking about my winning for 20 plus years and had been asking, you know, when are you going to win? Why haven't you won already? Etc. So, you know, when the call finally came on October 10th, 2012, I wasn't like amazed. Okay. I was very pleased. I was surprised, not that I had won the Nobel Prize finally, because as I say, people had been touting me for the prize for years, but I was surprised, one, that I had won that particular year because I had heard no rumors or leaks, if you will. You know, oh, this is Bob's year, et cetera. So I had none of that. The other thing that came as a bit of a surprise was that I won the prize in chemistry. I would have expected that if I ever won, I would have won in medicine. Yeah. Remember, it's medicine and physiology. But in that, the prizes, as you may know, are always awarded during a single week in October.
Yes.
And in a prescribed order, so that medicine is announced on Monday, physics on Tuesday, chemistry on Wednesday, etc. So, you know, it was Wednesday morning at 5 a.m. I mean, the medicine prize announced 2 days before. It wasn't me. I had no reason to be expecting that I would get a call on a Wednesday morning for chemistry, but then again, there it was. So it was a very pleasant surprise at that point. It was not one of these eureka moments where, you know, I felt like jumping up and down, as some do when they win the prize. It was more a matter of thinking to myself, well, this is nice. It was just sort of a quiet sense of satisfaction that this had finally happened. But life becomes very hectic after you win the Nobel Prize, especially the first couple of months and then the first year and the first few years. But then it never completely quiets down. People seem to think that Nobel laureates know about everything. And so it gives you not just a license, but almost a platform to pontificate on all manner of things that you know nothing about, so which I'm more than happy to do. So there's that. I mean, you just get so many invitations that you can't honor them all. So you have to learn to be very selective. You get all sorts of interesting opportunities that you might not otherwise have. For example, I, as all American Nobel laureates do, went to the White House just before we went to Stockholm to receive our prizes in December. I went to the White House and had the opportunity to meet personally with President Obama in the Oval Office. And that was a real treat. I don't know if you know that I'm at Duke University, which is one of the real national powerhouse teams every year in basketball, right? I mean, we have the famous Coach Krzyzewski, who is the winningest basketball coach in the history of college basketball. And as soon as I won, as soon as it was announced in October that I had won the prize, he called me up. We didn't know each other personally at that point, but I was a big fan of the team. I've had season's tickets since the 1970s. And he said, Bob, I'd like you to come down to Cameron Indoor Stadium. That's where the basketball games are played.
Yeah.
So that the team and the students can honor you.
Wow.
And that was just an amazing thing. I went down there and they called me to center court in a packed house. And the team and the coach presented me with my own Duke basketball jersey with my name on the back and the number one inscribed. And they put it on me. And then the team and the coach retreated and I was left standing at center court by myself while the fans and the students were screaming and yelling. And the Duke undergrads who sit closest to the actual floor are famous for chanting things at the players in unison. Most often negative chants that are chanted against the opposing players, typically when they're like fouling out of a game or something like that. But I could see that the students were chanting something at me and pointing. They were all pointing at me and chanting something. I couldn't hear it. And finally, it came into focus. They were going like this, and they were chanting, "He's so smart. He's so smart." I must say that that was a moment that I will never forget. So that's an example of a couple of opportunities that I've had that I would not have had were it not for the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, but I agree. You're so smart.
I don't know about that, but I, you know, I put on a good act anyway.
So Bob, how do you overcome failures in your research and projects as a scientist?
Say that again.
How do you overcome failures in your research and projects?
Well, the quick answer to that is often and every day, because failure is a daily occurrence in science. In fact, failure is overwhelmingly more common than success.
Yes.
We fail every day and we succeed only very occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
But the failures, of course, are what teach us what we need to do to ultimately be successful. One of the most difficult things for most of us to learn, if we ever learn it at all, is how to deal with the great amount of failure and frustration that is a necessary part of every day of a career in experimental science. I learned this lesson right at the beginning of my scientific career back in the late 60s. In my very first scientific experience, which was during a two-year assignment at the NIH during the Vietnam War, during that 2 years, that was my first really intensive exposure to the laboratory outside just the labs that you take in college and courses, et cetera. And I failed over and over and over again. I had a very difficult project that I was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say for a year and a half out of that 2 years, I met with nothing but failure. I was very depressed. And one of the most important things my mentors had to do was sort of keep me afloat emotionally because there was so much failure. One day I was at lunch and I was talking with a senior scientist who was not my mentor, but worked down the hall.
Mm-hmm.
He knew how miserable I was from all this failure. And he said, Bob, do you know what the difference is between an average scientist and an absolutely amazing, brilliant scientist, maybe even a Nobel laureate? I said, no, what is it? He says, well, you know, for an average scientist, maybe 1% of what they do actually works.
Mm-hmm.
He says, but for the world-class scientist, the top of the line, it could be as high as 2%. And I said, wow, that tells you something. Even for the best of the best, it fails 98% of the time. So I took that to heart, and I've passed that along to my trainees on many occasions. In fact, at Duke, I have a talk, a PowerPoint presentation I give from time to time to research trainees throughout the medical center called How to Deal with Failure and Research in Science, How to Deal with Failure and Rejection in Scientific Research.
Okay, yes. I think that was very inspiring. What do you do in your free time?
In my free time, well, that's changed a bit since the pandemic. But throughout my adult life, I have been an avid physical fitness buff. I used to do a lot of long distance running. Never ran a marathon, but I used to do a lot of half marathons, etc. But then I guess about 15 years ago, you know, my body was beginning to, you know, not like that so much. So over a period of time, I equipped my basement as a home gymnasium. It's every bit as good as a professional gym. I have four aerobic machines. I have an elliptical. I have a treadmill. I have a recumbent bike and an upright bike. Mm-hmm. Those are all in one large room with a TV up front. And then around in the back, I have a real professional grade gym with weights and things. So so physical fitness, I would say that I'm in my gym for about an hour every morning. Okay, wow. A little longer actually on the weekends. And then my other passion ever since I've been a little boy is reading, non-scientific reading. And I mean, let me see, what am I working on now here? So currently I'm reading, I'm always reading several books. One is this one is 1,000 pages that I'm reading. I'm about halfway through. It's a wonderful biography of Winston Churchill.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Okay. And yeah. Then here's another one that just came in, The Republic of Plato, which of course, like all college students, I read when I was in college, yeah. But I recently decided that I might give this another try. Mm-hmm. And here's an Agatha Christie mystery. I recently read, my wife has always been a devotee of her books. I had never read any prior to the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But now I read seven or eight over the last few months in between reading this heavier stuff. And I have other books up there. So yeah, I would say reading and physical fitness are my two major hobbies, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then another thing that's kept me busy in my spare time over the last couple of years is I've written a memoir. Yes. It's called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Stockholm. Yeah, and it is will be published on February 2nd by Pegasus Books, but it is already available for pre-order on all the sites, especially Amazon. And I encourage any of your listeners, viewers, who are interested in careers as physician scientists, yeah, to get a copy of that book, because in it I tell my whole story, of which you've heard just a tiny fraction.
But even that tiny fraction was really interesting. So I just wanted to ask, I was getting to that. Like, what made you write a memoir?
What you asked, what made me write the book?
Yes.
Yeah. So, as you might have gathered from our brief interaction here, I'm a bit of a storyteller, a raconteur. I love stories. I love telling stories. I love hearing stories. And throughout my career, I have regaled my trainees and anybody else willing to listen, and some who I'm sure rather they didn't have to listen, I've regaled them with stories of all kinds, usually with a humorous twist. Mm-hmm. And so for many years, people have been encouraging me to write up some of these stories. But I never thought I would get around to it. I've always been so busy. So then a couple of years ago, one of my former trainees, Dr. Randy Hall, who was a postdoctoral fellow with me in the 90s, who's now professor of pharmacology at Emory University in Atlanta, he was visiting because he's an ardent Duke basketball fan, as am I, and we were going to a game together. It's about 2 years ago. And we were at dinner before the game, and I was regaling him with stories. And, you know, it was the usual thing. He said, come on, Bob, you got to write these stories up. And I said, I can't do it. He says, look, he says, have you ever read the book, Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman? Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of that book?
Yes.
So this is a book by the Nobel Prize winning physicist, Richard Feynman, in which he was also a raconteur. He tells his stories, but he tells them to one of his former trainees, okay? And together they write them up. He says, let's use that as a model. Why don't you tell me all your stories? I'll write them up. You'll edit them. We'll put them together. We'll develop a narrative framework that works them into the story of your life. And we'll come up with a book. And so it caught me. I said, let's do it. So over the next year, I talked to Randy about 2 hours a week. He recorded everything. Mm-hmm. We started chronologically when I was a little, stories about when I was a kid, and went all the way through the present. We wrote them up. But the stories are all connected. And as I say, it's sort of a memoir, but illustrated by all these stories. So again, it's called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Stockholm. It is a funny book, but it's also a serious book. And I think for anybody who's interested in a career as both a physician and a scientist, they will find this book interesting, I hope amusing, and even more so, I hope inspiring.
Yes, of course. So the book is available for pre-ordering on Amazon right now, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, right now, absolutely. If you go to Amazon, and I'll send you, maybe you can post with this.
Yes, of course.
A copy of the book jacket so you can see it.
All right, great. I one last question. Do you connect with people through social media?
You know, that's a wonderful question. Prior to very recently, the answer would have been no. But in anticipation of the release of the book, I have established a LinkedIn account.
Okay.
Like 2 weeks ago, and I think I've connected to 50 people. So I now do, in fact, have an account. I can't say I go there very often, but my publisher, Pegasus Books, and my co-author, Randy Hall, have robust social media presences. I also have a Facebook account, set up for me by one of my daughters. I have five children, about 5 years ago. And I visit it about once a year. Don't have a lot of activity there either. But I do want to nurture this LinkedIn account.
Yes, of course.
Anyway, you can, please, thank you. I will certainly be happy to share the network.
Yes, of course. I think that concludes our interview. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
And
my pleasure. It's been,
no, you
been
go
fun
ahead,
talking. With you. No problem. It's been fun talking with you, and I hope your listeners enjoy our exchanges.
I loved our exchanges. Let me just say, I find you very inspiring. And
thank
if
you
you're reading Agatha Christie, just check out Murder on the Orient Express.
Okay, we'll
do. I love that book.
Okay, she's terrific.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.